Dr. Robert Rosine received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Concordia Teachers College, River Forest, in 1976. He received his MDiv from Concordia Seminary BA in 1972. His MDiv from Concordia Seminary in 1976. He then entered doctoral studies at Stanford University, where he studied under one of the preeminent Reformation historians of our generation, Dr. Louis Spitz. He received his PhD from that institution in 1986. Since then, Dr. Rosine has served as a guest instructor at Martin Luther Seminary in Papua New Guinea, as an assistant professor and now an associate professor of historical theology here at Concordia Seminary, as an acting director of library services, and as the faculty marshal. In the time that I have known Bob, I have come to the conclusion that here is a guy who is truly omnicompetent. He knows everything. He is not only one of the most widely read men that I have ever known, but he is one of the most thoughtful as well. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Rosine.
Omnicompetent. That's you can fool some of the people some of the time. It must be, students know it must be time for about a 50-minute shot because I have a cup of coffee, so here we go. It is nice to have a good introduction like that, although, as we all well know, there is many a speaker who has a good introduction who could stand a few good conclusions. We shall see how this turns out in the end. In the words of the prison chaplain, it's good to see so many of you here. Now, yeah. Erasmus said there are two things that stand in the way of knowledge. One is that one stands at the edge and turns away, having faced the danger. And the other is that having faced the danger, one fears going forward. Well, you saw yesterday that Paul Robbie has no fear. We went through the Bible in an hour. Today I plan to look at the long sweep of the church in culture in the same 60-minute block. Kierkegaard complained about what he called paragraph vultures, people who reduce others' work, life's work, to a few lines and then set it forth. And I suppose that after I'm through today, if Kierkegaard were alive, he'd be turning over in his grave. But this is not an impossible task, despite the ribbing I have taken from colleagues. After all, I teach H100, the Survey of Historical Theology, and with 30 periods, not counting the exams, we managed to go from Acts 15 to Bultmann. So I suppose this is not an impossible possibility here. A note to the Curriculum and Review Committee. If you're looking for an alternate route, what you have to do is take the Robbie Rosine method. You know, 1 hour on all the important things. Come to Concordia Seminary, give us a week, and we'll give you your MDiv. But it is... It is time now, friends, to get serious, which means dull. We heard yesterday about the culture war that's being fought, and I suppose today what we're doing is looking at a battle for the mind. And whoever wins this battle has a lot to say about who will win the war. Ever since Eden, people have done more than tend gardens. They've cultivated culture. Same root word, from family life to cities to civilizations. The Genesis 3 fall complicates matters with sin, but that hasn't stood in the way as people have built culture. Sometimes not the best way, not in a godly way. They've built monuments to the creatures rather than the creator. One thinks of the Tower of Babel as the epitome of that. Aristotle said man is a political animal, whereby the citizens, the politeis in the city, the polis, live naturally, reasonably in a societal mix. They seek how to order their lives. So cultures form. But we can do Aristotle one better, because we not only know that it happens, we know how it happens. Namely, not by accident, but by the design of God, who said, it is not good for man to be alone, and so he created a second. And from Adam and Eve, we get the start of society. Culture. Thus, people are by nature, by creation, social beings, creating culture from the highbrow down to the mundane. Now, in the New Testament time, nothing really has changed about that, although we live on the other side of the most profoundly influential event in history, namely the incarnation of God in Christ. The cross is not nearly as tall as Babel's tower, but its shadow stretches infinitely farther. Until the last day comes, people, Christians included, will continue to develop culture, creating, cultivating, building, shaping, reshaping, raising it, and starting all over. And until the last day, one of the big questions is how Christians, as God's new creation, Christ's people, his children, as people called to holiness and all those images, should be involved in the cultivating process. The whole creation is now rightfully Christ's, not all that is built glorifies him and reflects life as God meant it to be pursued. So how should we then live? It's a good book title. Before this goes farther, a few definitions and then a brief overview of where we're heading. First, for the title, I do not want to quibble over who fits in the category of Christians. I think those who confess Christ for our purposes will do nicely. I will not fixate on theological aberrations and argue that someone who does not comfortably accept the Lutheran confessions and should be cut out, that someone who could not comfortably live in the Lutheran camp, say, Zwingli with his impoverished Christology and his anorexic sacraments, that should not be allowed to stay. Zwingli, of course, was wrong, but he can stay. Arius, on the other hand, well, culture does not have to be defined at length either. Broadly put, it refers to anything, as Paul said yesterday, anything that is not biological. I was amazed at his definition. It was virtually the same thing I had down on my paper. Who's been reading whose stuff? Or it occurred to me that perhaps he and I worked together on the Septuagint in an earlier life. Well, it is non-biological creation, friends. So sleep, for example, is not a matter of culture. It is biological, although there's some of us who are trying to disprove that. There are people, on the other hand, in St. Louis, in some neighborhoods, who will sleep through August with windows locked and barred, while in small-town USA, the windows are open and the doors may even stand unlocked. And that says something about culture. Culture can refer to the simplest tools, the most elementary social patterns, to everything, really, that it is involved in developing, refining, shaping, training, the minds, the morals, the values, the attitudes, and the tastes. It reflects us, and it in turn shapes us. It gives us a view also of reality, what we think it is, and it in turn tells us what it ought to be. Understand culture, and we understand a great deal about ourselves. Protagoras said man is the measure of all things, so if you look at culture, you can measure man. People cultivate a culture, and the culture shapes them, from the highest with the liberal arts down to pop culture. We today will talk about quo vadimus. Where are we heading? Few people, well, there are a few people in the audience, who know that Quo Vadimus is the last cut on the first Chicago album, released 25 years ago. Now there's a cultural fact for you. And to prove I'm not omnicompetent, I didn't know that until yesterday afternoon at the reception when the person who knows told me that. Well, we seek to build things, cultures. We do it here at the seminary. We try to create a culture that shapes students, something that they will then carry forth with them at the end of their years, from the classroom, from worship, from devotions, from field ed, and on and on. One element of high culture pops up in the subtitle, in the person of Clio. Once familiar in classical antiquity, that people do not recognize Clio today may mean that Clio has no use, or, I hope, has merely fallen by the wayside and could be revived. Cultures change. Who's Clio? Clio is the muse of history, a name from the Greek for celebrating, making famous what historians do. This then is a look on one hand at the history of Christianity and culture intersecting, and on the other at the writing and the teaching of history that gives us a view of Christianity and all culture. And so the secret is out. This is a history lecture, camouflaged by the muse. But be honest, if I had put history in the title, I might have conjured up unhappy memories of classes past. And Elvis would not be the only one leaving the building. But I hope you do not go. This will be fun, I hope. It will be shocking, and in the end, unfortunately, it will not be pretty. But then the truth sometimes hurts, and it also frees. And so, at the risk of offending the muse, what I'm offering is an impression, a broad sketch. And I hope Clio has brought along her sister Calliope, the muse of eloquence. Time will tell. And I use Clio not to grandstand as a cultural elitist, although given what else passes for culture, that may not be a bad label. Clio's here to accent the fact that cultures change, and the fact also, as we shall see, that we too can use all sorts of things in the culture. I hope no one complains about using pagan antiquity. I personally have no patience for isolationists who would quarantine anything that doesn't pass pietistic muster. But before you rush to judgment, you should know that one of Lutheranism's heroes did something quite wonderful with the Greeks, too. But we'll save that for a few moments. Like ancient Gaul, my presentation is divided into three parts. First, a very breezy sweep through Christianity and culture, identifying a few pivot points. And for every instance I mention, I readily admit you can think of 10 more. That's fine. I'm here not to give the last word, but maybe only the first, and to further the discussion. Second comes a look at history, or more precisely, historiography, at recent trends and what they imply for our understanding of the past and what that does for our understanding also of the present. And what emerges applies not only to culture, but especially also to religion as it's analyzed. And the most recent trend especially targets Christianity as it threatens to trash Clio's mansions. And finally come some conclusions, a judgment, a warning, and a call to arms. But there is no place for sloganeering here. Yes, same basic principles always seem to hold, and yes, divine revelation speaks the truth and should be used. But spare us if all you want to do is tub-thump and toss out the same old passages and think, well, that settles the matter. Because all that does is it makes the speaker feel good and doesn't really help solve the problem. What we need is some shrewd analysis, knowing exactly where to cut the Gordian knot. Christ told his followers, as we heard a moment ago, to be in the world but not of it. As part of God's creation, his followers couldn't flee, but they had to find themselves and find their place in life's daily life structures, by which God sustains his work. Christians can't avoid being part of culture. As post-Pentecost Christians gave evidence of the hope that was in them, verbally and living lives marked by the Spirit, they came in contact with culture, overarching Hellenism and all sorts of subcultures too. They weighed and measured how much they could take in, how much they could use, what they could safely accept, and where the dangers were when they came to language, thought patterns, and so on. How to maintain integrity while integrating with the world and assimilating it into the household of faith, those who came to faith. Being culturally astute was important. Last Sunday, I know readings sometimes vary, last Sunday our first, our lesson was Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, see. I mean, there is a cultural bridge going on there, and Philip has to know how to get his foot in the door. It's interesting, the contact that goes back and forth. I think also of the eunuch there who says, please tell me what this text means. I'm not sure he could say that anymore these days. Well, I think also of Paul in Athens. He engages the Epicureans and the Stoics, and then they take him off to Mars Hill, where he gets another audience. It was a great example of Paul testifying, witnessing smartly, picking his opening, knowing what to say. And no doubt that sort of encounter went on countless times as the church grew. Christian witness met cultural resistance along the way. Jews resisted. They didn't want their cultures and their synagogues and larger communities upset. Others resented the Christians for a variety of reasons. Their refusal to accommodate other beliefs, their high morality that shamed others, their social leveling with neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, and so on. And when it came time to find an empire-wide diversion, Emperors Decius or Diocletian found the Christians easy targets. And that he could get away with it says something about how the Christians stood out against the culture, that they could be made scapegoats this way. Even before the empire-wide assault, you have Christians deciding that culture was disintegrating, and they fled to the desert. But from those early expressions, monasticism arose, a new element in culture. It arose and spread geographically and chronologically, and became quite an institution. It served well, and it also sent a mixed message. Early Christians had to be wary and shrewd in dealing with culture, to be careful how to engage and not be overwhelmed. And yet, despite all the disadvantages and the problems, their numbers grew. Some people estimate that by around the end of the 3rd century, they maybe were 10% of the population. And then things changed dramatically with Constantine's Milvian Bridge victory and the rise to the top. His vision, his conversion, and the Edict of Milan brought Christians into a prime position, but not without difficulties. Because while it's not fair, I suppose, to say Christianity became chic, certainly with such a famous convert, others came wanting to get in. How sincere were they? How would Christianity cope with the numbers and maintain its integrity as they brought in all the new people? While they carried the burden of trying to convey their culture, and as things began to disintegrate in the West, to carry on the culture that was left behind to them. Add new blood in the mix of the invasions, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Franks, the Vandals, the more the merrier. As pressure built up from the outside, with migrations to the East, these people first asked nicely, and when turned down, then they stormed in and fought their way into the empire. And the church faced a twofold challenge: to convert those to the faith who came unknowing or as Arians, and then secondly, to bear the burden of maintaining and conveying culture to the immigrants, especially as things unraveled more and more in the West. And the church and the Bishop of Rome came to fill the vacuum. Throughout it all came a profoundly important work of the church fathers, who built up quite an intellectual house. Erasmus once said that Christendom has had many martyrs but few scholars. But they, the church fathers, were scholars enough for the age. They looked at the New Testament message, grabbed hold of problems and questions and challenges, and they dealt with them all one by one. They really rethought the universe in Christian terms. Augustine deserves special mention with his City of God for the apology of Christianity and the approach to culture. The Middle Ages have been called a step backward, with the culture and church going into decline, especially when you get to the early centuries. But a closer look forces reconsideration. Despite limitations, for example, and despite problems, Gregory the Great provided a remarkable translation of the church into another era. It moved theologically, not always the way I would like, but then no one asked me, and geographically it moved into new directions. Rome's image, if not role, continued to grow, and you can complain about that, but it also served a useful purpose. And while it may seem that not much progress was being made, the church did an astounding job of continuing to cope with these people who kept coming in and settling down. The church kept its head above water and coped with the influx. Professionals, priests, and monks carried not only Christianity but cultural values out onto the frontier. The task is complicated as time goes on. Islam comes through, and culture is wiped out. The Christian church in North Africa all but vanishes there. The East fights to hold its own in a shrinking circle as another culture threatens to come in. And in the West, after Tours, the church still had to deal with Islam in Spain as cultures clashed and mixed. The ninth century brings an interesting twist. Once the empire with pagan culture had threatened Christianity. Then in Constantine comes an alliance, and then the burden fell to the church. But Charlemagne's Christmas Day coronation sees the church reviving now the empire, intending to use it for its purposes. But that works two ways. Charlemagne intended to use the church for his empire as a unifying factor. The revival would make for interesting drama as papacy and empire struggled, epitomized with Henry standing in Canossa's snow. Or take Innocent III, making and breaking kings and emperors in France and England and in the Holy Roman Empire. Excommunications, interdicts, rebellions, egged on rebellions and invasions of Italy, and the ouster of popes all make for juicy scandal, and they mark the long, sometimes misguided struggle to control culture and influence life on a more practical political plane. On another level, Christian theologians sought especially to bolster high culture, to show unity and complexity in a worldview, as they used scholasticism. Realism, moderate realism, nominalism, and variations all had pros and cons when it came to interpreting nature and supernature, theology, and daily life. Grand intellectual cathedrals were also erected, each offering an approach to understanding truth, reality. In the 12th century, there's a little spurt, a little revival of Aristotle, who got a fresh look. and his logic seemed to be the key to understanding everything, providing a workable method to order life and the Christian synthesis, in a Christian synthesis. But Aristotle was more than a tool for reasoned analysis. He also influenced theology. Another theologian would later argue, it is an error to say that no one becomes a theologian without Aristotle. This counters what is commonly said. Moreover, no one becomes a theologian unless it is without Aristotle. In short, all Aristotle is to theology as darkness is to light. The critic, Martin Luther. And he also wrote soon after, I believe simply that it is impossible to reform the church if the canons, the decretals, the scholastic theology, the philosophy, the logic as they now are not uprooted and another study installed. Luther saw that the hermeneutical impact that culture can have on theology. Despite objections and criticisms of its component parts, though, the Middle Ages served in the long range, in the long run, for Christian and cultural missions. Christianity and culture become strongly intertwined, for better and for worse. But by the end, the theology and culture also seem to be running on borrowed time. Two of the greatest works on culture come just at this juncture point. Jan Huizinga's The Waning of the Middle Ages, showing how a culture comes into a flower and then tails off. And then there's Jakob Burckhardt picking it up on the other side with his Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. The Renaissance was a rebirth of culture, first of classical Rome and then Greece. Christian scholars like Petrarch and Boccaccio, Salutati, Bruni, and others revived classical learning. They had a renewed emphasis on grammar, poetry, rhetoric, history, and moral philosophy, five long neglected core elements of the liberal arts that I think my students can recite in their sleep. After Petrarch discovered Cicero's elegance and wisdom, he called the Middle Ages the Dark Ages, 1,000 years without a bath. The Latin language brought Latin classical culture, and a bit more effort brought Greek for the study of New Testament, church fathers, and philosophy. The language and the culture brought the humanists into conflict then with the scholastics. Humanists read Greek. They knew Aristotle even better. And from classical study, they also knew that there were alternatives to dialectic and to logic. They wanted to use these. Revived classical culture then clashed with late medieval, but the scholastics held on to the universities, and they tried to stop the humanists from breaking into the inner ranks of the regular faculty at universities, where so much of culture was shaped. But that would change, and humanism would come to have a profound impact. German historian Bernd Müller has said simply, no humanism, no reformation. You might consider this refinement, no cultural revival, no Renaissance education, no reformation. Where and when Luther first became interested in the classical revival is still debated. Helmar Junghans has a huge book on Luther and the young humanists in German, and when all is said and done, you still can't quite find the day, the Enlightenment time there. When that became is still up for grabs, but Luther quite clearly supported and drew on this cultural movement. He became versed in the biblical languages. As a Wittenberg professor, he drew on humanists for his lectures. The tools helped him understand things like righteousness and what was meant by the just shall live by faith. Helped through his own theological problems, Luther did the obvious thing. He tried to bring it into the classroom to help others. Luther pressed for more humanist learning in the curriculum. When you read the correspondence from Friedenberg's history of the University of Wittenberg, it's interesting. Luther writes, we've lost the guy now who taught Occamist logic. Don't replace him. Spend the money on something else, on biblical theology. Reformation, Luther really pressed to bring the humanism into the curriculum. This is quite demonstrable. Reformation, as he first used the term, applied to the educational curriculum reform, sparked by a cultural revival. He even classicized his name, Eleutherius, the liberated one. 20th century humanism has gone secular, cutting God out of the picture. Renaissance humanism, centered on man also, but as the foremost creature of God, created in God's image. And humanists sought to find out just what that image was and to make the most of the gifts bestowed. The cultural revival then held great promise for theology with its texts and tools and its method, which is why Luther was insistent. Scholasticism with its logic had to go, and the new learning had to come. The Reformation then becomes the work of university men and educators, Melanchthon, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, and all the rest. They not only drew on Renaissance humanism, but over time they gave humanism a place to settle down in their ranks, turning it loose on anything and everything. The Wittenberg faculty, for example, published the so-called Pretenic Tables, the mathematical evidence that proved Copernicus's theory. Others were too chicken to do it, but the Wittenberg faculty did it. They had no fear of science and of learning. So reverse Bernd Muller's dictum from no humanism, no reformation, to make it no reformation, no humanism. The Reformation's passion for educational excellence, for giving society the cultural best, saw it use humanism across the board in drama, in history, in natural sciences, and still in theology, where elements fed into the late Reformation and the age of orthodoxy. They were so confident that they even brought Aristotle back, once spurned, although not everyone would. The Calvinists went the Peter Ramus route with a different approach to logic. But learning flowered. No wonder some of the Lutherans compared their schools to Eden. There's some wonderful treatises on this, glorying in the learning that's set up for culture and for true faith. 1,000 years after the early church first rethought the universe in Christian terms, the Reformation did it again. Beyond the familiar things like anthropology and soteriology and sacraments and ecclesiology, they rethought the place of the ordinary Christian in the world, a new view of good works and vocation and the Christian outlook on life. The layman is no longer simply the viator, the pilgrim passing through life trying to get to the world to come. Now true service comes not in fleeing tasks God would give for self-prescribed work behind cloister walls. Proper contemptu mundi, contempt for the world in sin, lay not in flight to the monastery, but in standing tall, rolling up their sleeves, spitting in the devil's eye, and saying, I'm not going anywhere. This world has been bought by Christ, and it is his, and I am his, and I am going to serve life as he and live life as he intended it to be. And as with the early fathers, the Reformation's impact on culture, on a worldview, is immense. The late Reformation and Orthodoxy continued to explore the intricacies while preserving the gems of Luther's Reformation, but complex theology left some observers wondering if we hadn't cut things too fine, and so the charge of dead orthodoxy arises. Unfair, but people act on their perceptions. Throw in then the devastation of the 30 Years' War with confessional allegiances prominently displayed, and a backlash is certainly to be expected. Pietism urged more heart to affect faith and culture, and deism ridiculed doctrinal theology in a traditional worldview. Dogma evaporates into virtue and ethics, and God weighs things in a moral balance. And all this happens no longer in the open world of a supernatural, imminent God who can come in and intervene, but in a closed universe made by a clockmaker who leaves things behind for us to fine-tune. But they thought they could do it. Optimism, expectations of progress, and autonomy all mark the Enlightenment. Traditional Christianity finds itself under siege, shoved aside by thinkers in centuries to come, who will take elements of Christianity, recast it, claim they've saved the essence, and then try to push our types aside. They create their own new blend. The new era expected improvement now, and life seems more transparent. Francis Bacon shed light on how we think and how we form worldviews with his explanation of idols. And Descartes outlined idols are things that are presuppositions, prejudices, and if we step back, we realize what they are. And of course, you all know idols should not be worshipped. Idols should be smashed and done away with. He doesn't get quite that blunt, but people put two and two together. Descartes outlined a method to cover all the bases and to provide sure knowledge. Those are huge contributions to the age of reason. It distances itself from the Reformation. And as the world changed, descendants of the Reformation used Cartesian thought to cement a grand synthesis of learning and truth. Descartes becomes their Aristotle. By Enlightenment's end, man had moved from the object to the subject of scrutiny. Immanuel Kant illustrates that with his shift. We shift to self-discovered morality found inside, and it replaces revealed theology relegated now to simply unenlightened metaphysical theory. While the Enlightenment's effects stretched on, others in the 19th century offered revamped Christianity while taking swipes at the Enlightenment out of which they grew. Hegel, an idealist on the move, thought Kant was defective, since Kant stands still, so to speak, as he tries to examine life. But Hegel moves, history is on the move, on through dialectic, heading toward absolute truth, ever upward and onward. Reason is the engine that drives this all, reason, capital R, that fills the world and moves and makes it go. And along the way, theology for Hegel is aufgehoben, elevated, purified on a higher level. What does that mean? Theology, once the queen of the sciences, has given way now to philosophy, which Hegel insists still contains the essence. Some theologians were glad to be rid of the old-style religion, and they embraced Hegel as a kind of Christian apologist, because after all, he had at least posited absolute truth in a kind of, and that makes it a kind of faith statement. But from a Reformation benchmark, Hegel's thin stuff. But some of Hegel's students thought he'd quit too soon and left religion sort of twitching it might make a comeback. So Ludwig Feuerbach challenged absolute truth, locating God not outside but inside, simply as something that we project, humanity self-alienated to an image of God. And when people said, "You're an atheist," he said, "How can I be an atheist? To say that God, my fiction that I create, my really self-analysis looking in the mirror, if God doesn't exist, I don't exist." That, frankly, is playing with words. No, what he's got is better put, let us make God in our own image. Karl Marx complained that Feuerbach failed to see that ideas like God were born from socioeconomic conditions. They don't spring simply full-blown from the head of Zeus, sort of automatically. Change the conditions, and the idea born of the conditions will change. Put another way, create economic justice, and there is no need for the fiction of a God who holds out the fiction of a hope for some fiction of a future life. For both Feuerbach and Marx, Christianity, true Christianity, is hollow. The world belongs to the psychological, to the socioeconomic materialists, who will now define culture's values and directions, and so they want to do. You should know, by way of parentheses here, that not the whole world doesn't go this way, but these people don't always stand around to carry on conversation nicely. They go full speed ahead and sort of wreck everything along the way and create waves, while some of us are sort of bobbing along the side. We shouldn't do that anymore. The most honest and frightening voice along the line is Nietzsche's, with a challenge to conventional atheism. Christianity wasn't worth his effort. God is dead, and then all that depends upon God, morality especially, does not exist. And we have done the deed. We have pushed culture so far that we don't need these kind of props from Christianity any longer. Can anyone who really sees the implication then stay sane? No God, no transcendent values, no morality, no truth. You should watch your back and be careful. Who has the nerve to face such an existence? Few apparently did. Nietzsche was too much for most, and so people look elsewhere. Kant gets revived in one strain of Protestant liberalism by Albrecht Ritschl. The Hegelians of both wings continue to assert truth, be it in the absolutes cleaned up, or in anthropology within or socioeconomic forces at work in the world. But the optimistic culture growing since the Enlightenment comes down in a crash in World War I, a slaughter not seen to date. In the war's wake, some tried to pick up the pieces where they'd been and carry on without much success. Others, shaken, people like Karl Barth, tried to revive some of the older approaches to God with updated twists, and the result comes out in neo-orthodoxy. Others tried variations of existentialism, and a few even honestly cozied up to Nietzsche's nihilism, suggesting there is no bottom. We call a halt at this point to the historical blitz, having suggested somehow some broad trends go in Christianity and culture. And as I said before, there are all sorts of gaps for you to fill in. We go rather now to part two in Gaul and pick up the writing of history, noting how it reflects and influences culture, which is at work even as it studies other cultures. History traditionally has focused on political and intellectual, on events and ideas, those elements that shape society, people's lives, their beliefs, their cultural values. And that view tends to be from the top down, not to ignore the little people, but because the movers and the shakers have stood out by virtue of having made a difference and affected others. Trickle down and ripple out, and I think actually does work. The great figures are not made by spin doctors, but because when people quite honestly look at them, they say in the balance, well, this man probably overall is worth more. Take Luther on one hand and Andreas Nydecker on the other. You know, how many of you have ever heard of Andreas Nydecker? Maybe my wife, because I think she saw it once, maybe, in a paper that I wrote. Andreas Nydecker was a Catholic humanist who wrote one treatise in his life on education, a kind of bad knockoff of a thing that Luther had done, or so I theorized. And from what I can tell, it didn't even sway the city council in his own town to make changes in education, which is what he was after. Instead, they adopted the Reformation. Poor Andreas. Now, which of those two do you think, quite honestly, if set before you, you would say is the more important man? Well, great figures, then, I think, have a place because of what they honestly do. Well-written, though, traditional history has never spurned the details, never forgotten the Andreas Nydeckers of the world. The better historians knew always that as they wrote, they always had to be aware of the fact that they're working with certain evidence at hand. They had their biases. They had to watch out lest they read things back in. And they're always open to revision as time goes on. They distilled facts trying to discover a coherent pattern in the subject, and they're open to revision as new evidence weighs in. The first decades of this century, though, have seen other approaches arise and challenge. Social history works on a local level to find a slice of common life, a common picture, and you get these narrower case studies, something like, oh, say, a French village, life in a French village as it goes mildly and blithely on and then is disrupted as a pilgrimage chapel is built in its midst. And you get a kind of sort of look at life. And if you multiply these kinds of studies, I suppose you could say you get a big picture, assuming they're kind of all talking about the same thing. But that's really not necessary, these people would say, to do it right. And a variation comes in quantitative history, massaging statistics to get a picture of the average life. And so we count pigs and pigsties to understand life. But isn't there more? I think these people don't always understand that there is a difference between cumulative and non-cumulative knowledge, and that history generally works in the non-cumulative side to look for great ideas and for truths. And simply because I add up all sorts of things doesn't necessarily mean I've learned something. I mean, you know, there's this famous line from Louis Namier, 50 men do not make a centipede. Well, and I would remind these people of the 11th commandment revealed not to Moses but to W.H. Auden, thou shalt not commit a social science. Well, psychoanalytical history puts the long gone out on the couch to study the mind, like Erik Erikson does in Young Man Luther. Problems with misunderstanding evidence that's there, relying on rumor, things that Erikson was charged with doing, certainly can be overcome. The objection in Erikson's case is that when people rebutted him and said, these stories you've picked up, in fact, are fictions set out by Catholic propagandists long ago, the answer was a shrug, and he said, well, they're consistent with the picture that's there. You know, well, that's a little... But I think really the problem comes when you look at the psychological framework used. Erikson's happened to be Freud. Does the framework presuppose that religion cannot actually be true, but only deals with people's perceptions, what they feel to be true, while psychological development actually shapes ideas? Well, we can sort of throw a bomb at this point with Roland Bainton's famous line that there are grave difficulties in psychoanalyzing the dead. And then we move on to the Marxists, who weigh in dismissing the idea that individuals make history. Instead, history is always made by groups, always driven by socioeconomic forces, no matter what else seems to be the case, and it inevitably leads toward the betterment of the social common man. And while those elements, I would admit, might, on occasion, prove true, they can weigh into the mix. The Marxist insistence was that they always must be there, and that is the only way to understand history, and that, frankly, reduces history to ideology. And yet one more innovation, the Annales school from the French social historians, those of you writing notes, that's A-N-N-A-L-E-S. The Annales school is epitomized by Fernand Braudel's famous work, His Mediterranean and the Mediterranean World in the Age of Philip II. The goal of the Annales school in the end is to determine the mentalité. That's as much French as you'll get out of me today. The mind. What was the mind of an age like? And a mass of trivia is organized by treating history as if change comes in terms of structure and conjuncture. Structural shifts are slow and glacial, all but imperceptible till you look back over the long centuries. Conjuncture changes, those are short-term things. Those are things we think are important, depressions, wars, and so forth. But in the end, they are swept aside by the long-range changes. We have to ask, though, is the picture accurate? See? Is this something that comes out of the data naturally, or have we sort of conceived of this? And once it seems to work, we're going to force everything else into the pattern. And what do we do with the detail? Braudel explains all sorts of detail about the Mediterranean world. My famous example is his discussion of the use of camels on some trade routes and dromedaries on another, because they have different hoof structures, which are better suited to certain terrain, which leads them in certain ways. He goes on about this in the first of his two volumes. And in the course of this, do you know how many times I think he mentions church? Only in passing, even. Twice. Not till the second volume does religion come up for discussion. And I would really wonder whether the peasant thought more of camel and dromedary hoofs, or whether he thought more of church when he saw the village church in his midst and he heard its bells ring every day. See? I mean, it says something about the man's presuppositions coming to the work. These variations of the new history all weigh in on Christianity and culture. They treat religion sometimes as a group phenomenon, sometimes as psychology verbalized, sometimes as statistics rather than from a dogmatic perspective, and on and on. Please note, there are certainly things to be taken from this. These approaches do serve at times, but the problem is more and more that people who are in these camps weigh in and say that they must be had, and that the old way has been wrong, and that they absolutely must be heard, that they have the truth. They argue wrongly the traditional approach was never interested in the wider view of life, and they seek its ouster. And that brings a radical shift in the writing of history and how the past is conceived, and that in turn necessarily also affects the way in which we think then maybe we should look at our present. It was Hegel, I think, who said that God tolerates historians. He finds them useful because they can rewrite. God can only create, but historians can recreate. And yet, to this point, for the most part, all these approaches at least have agreed on one thing, that there is a truth to be known. They disagree on what it might be. They bring all sorts of baggage with them, but at least even the Marxists, who've softened some of their opposition to religion's place, they all at least agree that there is a truth to be had. And if patient long enough, they may actually arrive at some sort of common ground. But since then, things have disintegrated. Postmodernist history has stormed in. And with this, we move from part two to three. Assuming postmodernism has arrived, what kind of attitude are you going to take? Living in an age, I would hope, does not necessarily make you a true postmodernist. But being here, what are you prepared to do about it? You can accept, capitulate, sell out. You can grapple and seek to overcome. You cannot control the age into which you were born, but you can take advantage of the situation even if it's not to your liking. The early Christians did it. Some say they're glad to be here, but be careful before you rejoice at the death of modernity and embrace postmodernism with a smile. You might as well, I think, throw gas on the fire. There is a very shrewd, tough-minded, wonderful woman, a historian named Gertrude Himmelfarb, who has been an apologist for traditional history. She recounts some very frightening episodes in her new book called Looking into the Abyss. Yesterday we heard in the first lecture a reference to the abyss. Nietzsche talks about it, but it also comes up in her title, Looking into the Abyss. She tells of ill-prepared, confused, unsuspecting students who are led to the age of postmodern nihilism, who look into the abyss and are apathetic, blasé, and even amused by what they see. They don't understand. And worse are the educators who lead them there and who come away smiling at the converts made. If Nietzsche were alive today, to see people laughing at this as if it were a parlor game, I think it would kill him. He'd think they're really stupid. He understood. Postmodernism is not simply a time of confusion and competing voices. This has always happened with rival claims of truth and reality. But past ages, even modernity, agreed the truth lay somewhere, and they believed it ultimately would win out. And they worked at it, and they had a little bit of patience to do it. In postmodernism, objective truth is nowhere to be found, and that is said so up front. It exists only for me as I make it. Carl Henry has written ominously, "No fact of contemporary Western life is more evident than its growing distrust of final truth and its implacable questioning of any sure word." In the absence of final truth and absolutes, it becomes impossible to argue that Christianity really has even made an important, maybe even the most important contribution to Western civilization, at least. And postmodern relativists would argue, then, that a historical sketch about Luther's barber is as important as a study about Luther's evangelical breakthrough. The only advantage I might see is that maybe the barber knew when the breakthrough happened. The detail adds spice, but where is the sense of proportion of a subject's worth? This approach to history and culture produces books and articles and conference papers on things like cross-dressing in English society, cod pieces on Elizabethan costumes, and the history of dirt. Should we delight that modernism has been toppled and replaced by permanent chaos? Doesn't that mean we all get an equal hearing and will be respected and tolerated? Himmelfarb comes to the rescue again. It is not automatically guaranteed by postmodernists. In fact, those who know what they're doing want to control, but they are reluctant often to admit it. A rare bird is Duke University's Stanley Fish, an apostle of deconstructionism. He admits that the only absolute is the lack of one, and therefore he's honest, I think, about where this leads. Fish rejoices that the death of absolute truth has, as he says, relieves me of the obligation to be right and demands only that I be interesting. Fish did a lecture tour, and some of us walked over to Wash U a couple of years ago and listened to him. When he was all done talking about the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment and free speech, he concluded that the amendment finally means what we want it to mean, and that speech is only free if we decide we want it to be free and will allow it. The we is a community banded together to claim some sort of privilege. Sometimes we become a community and gain status by claiming victim states. And we read then into the text something, and we impose it on others. It is a matter of power. It is a matter of votes. Superior numbers mean influence, and the text interpretation is a matter of power. Anything called truth that has no real roots. It's an artificial creation of those who hold power and define meaning and impose it as now the acceptable orthodoxy. And that is totalitarianism. We object that words have been uncoupled from the larger reference point, making the power grab the only reasonable thing then to do. I mean, pragmatically, if you're going to argue that way up front, then what they do makes sense. The proponents argue that they could not have emasculated words since there are no higher corresponding reference points, which sounds to me strikingly like a rehash of old medieval nominalism's claim that reality exists only in individual particulars and that higher concepts and truth are only artificial constructs that we create down below from collected experience. And so we know only what we have experienced, and no two people experience exactly identically the same thing, and so no two people can ever really be sure of a communication bridge built between the two, which makes for chronic uncertainty about anything other than their own thoughts. The classic skeptics used to say, "All I know is that I know nothing," and then they said even that is up for grabs. They said, "I don't know that I can ever really honestly say anything for certain because of the perceptions. Have I taken everything into account? And even if I could know it, I'd be sure, as much as I can be sure, that I could never tell it to you and that you'd understand it anyway." Today we hear people argue that we cannot read an author's mind and we cannot determine his intent. And when we say, "Well, let's just stick then with the text, that will do, he's put that out on paper," then we're told that it has no meaning until I decide and invest meaning in it from my own reading. And then I think again of the Ethiopian. Well, accepting someone else's meaning enslaves me, and I need to strike out against that. You know, catechumens of the world unite. Infusing my own meaning now, however, empowers and liberates me. A century ago, Max Stirner declared that as long as you believe in truth, you do not believe in yourself, and you are a servant, a religious man. Stirner's part of the left-wing crowd that culminated in Nietzsche with an assault on objective truth and a call for us to become our own creators, our own gods. And how do we get to this point? Studies abound. Some have traced the problem's historical pedigree. Some have focused on the arena for the struggle today, namely the school system, and some try to do both. I have down here on my text at this point a footnote that's that long with nothing but titles. Yeah, people have to look up. It's about 5 inches long, with things like Bill Bennett's Devaluing of America, or Thomas Sowell's Inside American Education. There's the great Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind that people protested over and over again was quite wrong. I think they did protest too much. There's Bruce Wilshire's Moral Collapse of the University. That's really interesting. That's really interesting. I went to Wash U to buy that book and encountered someone who was just, he was thrilled because he said, oh, that conservative Bloom didn't get it, but Wilshire's got it right. Well, what Wilshire finally does is he says, the problem comes in the fragmenting of the university is that people bought into Descartes, into his method. And if you understand and can use this method, you can understand anything and everything because everything is laid out for you. Everything is considered, see. I step back out of a picture, I analyze, and then I come back in. Well, there are problems with that. First of all, as soon as I step back out of a picture, I've changed the picture in a sense. And secondly, it only works if I have kind of a manageable whole, see, which has caused then university departments to become increasingly tunnel visioned so that even, say, in engineering, chemical engineers can't talk to electrical engineers anymore. You know, and historians certainly can't talk to engineers, and on we go. In grad school, when we lived in the high-rise housing, we used to have potlucks, and the first rule of thumb was that nobody talked about what they were doing because after 30 seconds, nobody understood anybody anyway. Well, one recent study that just came out is George Marsden's Soul of the American University. It details the clash of a Protestant worldview and values, with Protestantism on one hand falling all over itself to try and minimize its differences and sort of accent commonality so that we looked good and made a good case. Meanwhile, science, on the other hand, is pushing and shoving it right outside the university. It's real interesting. It's a wonderful book. Marsden, George Marsden, The Soul of the American University. Looks like this. On the front cover illustration is Stanford's chapel with the Sermon on the Mount on top. It's redone. When it was first done, it said to the glory of God and in memory of Leland Stanford, you know. And then came the earthquake and it came tumbling down, and Wag said it was because on the front of the chapel Leland Stanford's name was bigger than God. to which the response was, around Stanford, Leland Stanford was bigger than God. And in a sense, there is something to that remark, because what happened was, for example, in the first president, David Starr Jordan came, a wonderful man in many respects, but he was a Unitarian and, as he said, a kind of Puritan moralist. And he came out and wanted kind of a general homogenized Protestantism, which on the one hand sort of became so watered down that it really kind of lost its punch. Meanwhile, science went to town. And increasingly then, Christianity is sort of marginalized. Maybe there's hope, though, yet. The new president of a year or two ago is a man named Gerhard Kasper, who came from Chicago U. Kasper, as I understand, is a Lutheran, ELCA, I think. He came for his inaugural, and he must have actually given the science folk at Stanford Tech, he must have given them fits. Because in the course of his inaugural address, his vision for the university, he cited past wisdom. Two names came up. Ulrich von Hutten, who has the motto, Die Luft der Freiheit weht, the winds of freedom blow. It's the only university with a German motto. And what was Ulrich von Hutten talking about? He was talking about the Reformation. And the other person that Kasper quoted several times was Martin Luther. Well, you know, there is yet another work that I want to hold up and pitch for you. One that comes from town here, Ed Beath's Modern Fascism. It's a little book with a shocking title, but it's serious business. Fascism conjures up images of Hitler and Mussolini, and we say we've won the war, the shooting has stopped, and we think fascism is consigned to the dustbin of history. But the problem remains, because the ideology, the thought, has carried right on. Fascism is totalitarian. It is an attempt to liquidate the Judeo-Christian tradition and the worldview, buttressed by absolute truths, by transcendent moral laws, by references to God. And all this stuff has its reference finally back in God. In its place, fascism substitutes a worldview rooted in human identity, driven by a will to power, To maintain religious cultural components, then, what they do is they go to pre-Christian or pagan or tribal ideas to replace Christianity, not because they're true per se, but because, in fact, they have no transcended truth and reality, and instead they simply are used to kind of organize thought and channel human aspirations as they crowd out Christian values. Primitivism is verbalized, but it really highlights that the human will is creating this all, investing it all with value and meaning. In fascism, myths that are put there by us, and criticism is heaped on words and symbols to shove them aside, unless they have meaning that we put there, and they have no meaning until we put meaning in them. There is a kind of unholy alliance then that it emerges, as Beith shows: postmodernism, deconstructionism, fascism, totalitarianism. The relationships are complex, but they again are quite demonstrable. At this point, I'm sure I have students who are blanching. They have today due, and some of them have shoved under my door, a review of Beith's book, What's It All About? Now you know what you should have written. And in good postmodern fashion, I have the microphone and I hand out the grades. But more interesting about Beith's book, you should know this. He was interviewed on the radio. And someone who heard the interview was much taken by what he heard, bought a number of the books, and in the course of making contacts and sending them out, sent it out to a woman whose name is Alberti, which probably means not much to you. She happens to be a translator for Alexander Solzhenitsyn. She was taken by the book, and she in turn sent a copy to him, and he apparently was much impressed. So I think there is something to it, you know. We say, well, it comes, you know, from in-house, from our circles. You know, prophets not without honor. Václav Havel, now president of the Czech Republic, told the U.S. Congress once, consciousness precedes being. What did he mean by that? Well, Havel came out of Eastern Europe that had weathered politically imposed totalitarian darkness and was now coming into the light. Even as we in the West seem to be rushing into a kind of culturally enforced night. And so Havel comes before the Congress and says, consciousness precedes being. And Congress, of course, didn't get it at all. Until he added the line, consciousness precedes being. Consciousness precedes being, and not the other way around is the Marxists claim, which, of course, then drew applause because Marxism has been said to be an error. But exactly what was Havel's point? Simply and profoundly this. That there is a larger transcendent reality that shapes our identity and our being. We don't shape it. Totalitarianism, on the other hand, creates its own artificial truth by an act of will, by an exercise of power. The tragedy is that in so much of postmodern America, we insist on embracing what Havel and others have been thrilled to escape. They knew this, but for decades, the political state was able to impose control. In our circles, the government, though visible, is not nearly as immediately effective and can't repress that way. It comes in, its role comes in by the back door. Instead, cultural institutions, say schools, for example, are where our outlook and understanding of reality are shaped. Control them, you control the worldview. And political expression then follows. To put it a bit more concretely, in a classroom, a cultural institution, you teach an understanding of the ideal family. You say, well, father knows best, never really happened, that can't be the model, and so instead we read Heather Has Two Mommies. And as a result, you create a new reality, which then turns around, goes running off to the government to muster political support to ensure its legitimacy, and to be then declared true. It is not easy to resist, with postmodernism at every hand drumming home the message that overarching absolutes cannot and do not exist, and that everyone is entitled to a version of reality. And since texts mean only what we want them to mean, we cannot claim to teach an objective truth. And then the pressure is on, even on to churches, to come round, to change. We have to rewrite our myths, we're told, to rework our past. Power, then, will define culture. We prayed in chapel this morning for truthful education. I hope you prayed real hard. As committed postmodernists then comment on the present and look back on the past to rewrite history, there is an arrogance that permeates their hectoring. Traditional history is dismissed as the propaganda of victors, which means that traditional historians must fundamentally be dishonest people who are not interested in the truth And this further implies that the postmodern historians must be right and honest and good people for having exposed this scandal. The fact is, they have their own agenda. Himmelfarb, to use her yet one more time, writes bluntly, "If postmodernism appeals to the creative imagination of the historian, it also certainly appeals to the political imagination." And so after all this, where are we? The jury is still out, but at least some obvious conclusions can be drawn. First, there is cause for concern. Traditional historians are no fools. They can count noses in their classes and down the hall at the feet of the Marxist feminists and see where the tide is going. They can read the jobs advertised in the Chronicles of Higher Education and in the publications from the American Historical Association. They read the retirement announcements and watch the replacements. And in all honesty, the trend is not good. I don't want to get into naming names and institutions and unnecessarily make enemies, but suffice to say that when it comes to my field of Renaissance and Reformation, it is, as it's called at universities, if a person today wants to take a traditional approach, even concentrate on theology as a major development, the pickings are getting slimmer all the time. One friend, now retired, remarked that he was the last openly committed believing Christian in his history department. And when he started a generation ago, that had just been routine. And with the younger student generation being steered in the other way by younger faculty, things are only going to get worse until somebody in Petrarch-like fashion, who, when he stumbled on Cicero, stumbles on the reformers and is captivated by their thought. And then we will get a renaissance in Reformation studies. It would be nice if seminaries could lead the way, but then as long as theology is taken seriously, then, of course, traditional seminaries are simply dismissed as being benighted. Of course, that shouldn't also dissuade us from producing for a day when finally historiographical renaissance will come. And what can be done about the threat of cultural hegemony played out through the university? Well, we may need political involvement, as we heard yesterday. Realists and pragmatists will be tempted to fight fire with fire, to meet power with power, and to play it the postmodernist way. And it could get ugly, and those suggesting that route had better count the cost, lest they start something that they can't finish. And then we have to ask what kind of larger witness that finally gives. Here's a decision. How do we intersect with culture? To be sure, God will get done what he wants and will preserve his word in church, but he uses members of Christ's body to do it, and so we want to use talents and opportunities and stay in the culture-shaping game. On the positive side, we have talented, committed people who are willing to wade in and put forth the best effort to give evidence of the hope that's in them, to try and work in history. Luther remarked once, histories are nothing other than the indications, memorials, tokens of divine works, judgments, and so forth, telling us how God preserves, rules, checks, punishes, and honors the world in general, especially people, as each one deserves good or evil. So if we're serious about the Spirit working in the Word and about God working in history to achieve purposes, then finally I suppose we have to say numbers and being in a minority do not ultimately matter. Postmodernism now rules the roost and is expanding its historiographical circle. But humanly speaking, we at least have one last thing going for us. We have their number. We know what's going on, and we know where the postmodernist agenda leads. The empire may be growing for the moment, but the truth is the emperor has no clothes. He is a false pretender to the throne of legitimate history and would not even make a good court jester because, as we know from history, the court jester, the fool, was expected and agreed to tell the truth. Drawing from his culture, Harvard historian Crane Brinton has adopted a biblical allusion when he turned the phrase and said, "Clio has many mansions." And there's the last piece of the title, Patient Folk. Postmodernism doesn't only want one of the mansions, it wants everybody else expelled, evicted. Wise people ought to bar the door. St. Bernard once wrote, "To possess what one knows nothing about, what glory is there in that?" What glory indeed. So as Christians, we look at culture and at history, and we could do well to echo Luther's observation on how to approach it. He said this, "Wenn es zur Theologie kommt, eine gewisse Bescheidenheit gehört dazu." That is, when it comes to theology, we could say to history too, a certain humility is called for. And he advised just that as he penned his last lines ever, a comment that shows he saw value in history as a teacher. And culture comes in for praise as well. I said at the start that I would tell you that I hope no one would balk at using favorably the pagan Greeks, and I promised to tell you of an example of a prominent churchman doing the same. Well, here it comes, and it's Luther, sifting wisdom from pagan cultures and then taking a Christian view. He even corresponds the Bible to the Aeneid, tracing not a seven-year wandering of a Trojan hero, but a longer journey of God's people from the start of time through history toward their final home. Here is Luther's advice on living life well and in faith. As culture, history, and theology intersect in this presentation for one last time. No one who has not been a shepherd or a peasant for 5 years can understand Virgil and his bucolics and his Georgics. It's a writing about agricultural life. And I hold that no one can understand Cicero and his letters unless he has been involved in efforts to govern the state for 20 years. And let no one who has not guided congregations with the prophets for 100 years believe that he has tasted Holy Scripture thoroughly. Because of this, the miracle is tremendous in John the Baptist, Christ, and the apostles. He means in what was accomplished. Lay not your hand on this divine Aeneid, but bow before it and adore its every footsteps. We are beggars. This is true. Thank you.
See what I mean? We have approximately 6 or 7 minutes that we can take for questions. Whoever has questions, I would invite you to come forward to the microphones and speak clearly into them.
Christianity Today.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, Armin Bolme from Minnesota.
Thank you.
Christianity Today recently had on the cover and several articles about fighting the culture wars. Dr. Peters in Dialogue magazine raised the question, should Lutherans get engaged in the culture wars? And you alluded some to that at the end. The importance of how we fight the good fight, so to speak, in that. Would you mind elucidating a little bit on that for us, please?
In simply put, talked a lot, I won't talk much to that. It seems to me, yes, it's very obvious that people need to be involved. In fact, I would say you can't avoid it. I mean, if you are human, you are here and you are part of a culture. Then you have to say to yourself, fine, am I going to be marginalized, swept aside, and have my values imposed, or am I at least going to stand up and say something, and at least make my case? Admittedly, to say there are transcendent values is a matter of a faith statement. You know, I mean, you cannot prove ultimately those things in Christianity. Christianity, Carl Michelson says, is like a hinge. There on the one hand is the historical fact, and on the other side the existential message that comes to it. That is to say, there are events that happen, and if you don't have the events, you're in trouble. No resurrection, you know, then your faith is in vain. On the other hand, the existential side, the promises, where this all leads there is rooted. See, the promises of God, and that's where faith comes in. You cannot prove that, but does that therefore mean that automatically, because it's that sort of relationship, that you're shoved aside? The sort of extreme nominalist comes and says, well, that's simply a matter of theory. This is the way it works. You know, forgetting the whole time that was proposed is just as much of a theory, on the other hand. We just went through Feuerbach. I told you I wouldn't say much. We went through Feuerbach a couple of days ago in one of my classes, you know, and we looked at his proof for the non-existence of God. See, because I have this idea, because within me, I posit this theory around me that in fact God is no more than my projection, and therefore there is no true God, as people commonly say. And suddenly, you know, comes the point you say, how do you know that? You can't prove that any more than I can prove, ultimately, you know, the traditional Christian message in a totally empirical way. See, so you've got them at a standoff, and that's fine. You know, that's as far as I can go. I'm willing to go that far and then make my pitch, because at that point, you see, I also have confidence in the Spirit's work. through law and through gospel. By telling him, you're not so fast, you know, your system doesn't work. That's the kind of law preachment. It really is. And then I make my pitch as best I can. You know, Paul did it. People have been doing it for generations since. Yeah, I mean, you got to do it. Please.
One of our present Christian writers has said that he found only signs of Christian culture twice in the last 2,000 years. And that was at the time of Augustine and the time of Queen Elizabeth in the latter part of our time. And, of course, I can't quite understand why we talk of cultures as having being at war with them. I've been a missionary for 41 years, and the biggest mistakes we've made is not understanding the culture where we are, and by trying to disapprove of things in the culture that we did not understand. We have about 2,000 cultures in the world, and we have decided that the United States is the most important place to do mission work. There are dozens of cultures here. And the biggest problem is that we aren't ready to meet them because we don't know how to understand culture. And this is another culture. We, about 35 years ago, we met with the board at Ann Arbor, and both presidents of the seminaries were there. And we cajoled and pleaded and finally convinced them that they should add some staff that would help us to understand different cultures, especially as we find it in the mission field. And they finally agreed to us, but nothing has ever happened. And so the students who are graduating from the last 100 years are not ready to preach the gospel to every nation because they don't know how to understand the people with whom they're working. Right now, we're working with the Fulanis in Nigeria and West Africa. There are 15 million of them, and we don't understand their culture, really. We understand a lot of things about it, but we don't really understand them.
Go
ahead.
Say sort of three things to that. Use the word understand several times. I mean, that's very important, and I hope it came across here that the first thing the early church did, and the people who did it right ever since, was to understand the world in which they were. Once they did that, then they could engage. And once you understand, then you have a legitimate basis for saying, I can criticize. I mean, to say, once I understand, understanding culture does not mean also that I therefore have to accept everything about the culture.
Yeah.
But at least then I can be smart about it,
mm-hmm.
and I can do it right. And I wonder, and this is just sort of surmising, I wonder if some of this sort of this inattention that comes and these sort of quick fixes and things, I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why you could spin this out and say, you know, it's part of the American mind, we do this, or, you know, this led us to this. But I wonder if it's not a little bit of this kind of this idea that, well, there finally are no absolutes, you know. So do I need to really, I can then simply sort of say, well, mine is better than yours. I mean, there's sort of faint echoes in there, a little bit of power. Once again, you know, I will give lip service to understanding cultures, but here's what you really need.
We bring in too much of the Western culture and expect that should be part of the Word of God, and we're far from it. You know, it's one of the worst things we do. And so culture, to me, has a lot of different meanings. And the Western culture is the worst thing of all.
Okay, if we would like, we can continue the conversation immediately afterwards.
Can I say one more thing? I started off with enough for 3 hours, and I think went only one. So if you're interested in more stuff and in the bibliography, this is a commercial for the symposium committee. When the things are finally published, the four essays, you can buy yourself a little copy for $5 and find out a lot more. Was that good?
You do it like this.
It's in the bookstore. It's time for lunch. We're going to reconvene at 1 o'clock with the section O's.